And welcome to the third episode of the weekly Google Cloud Platform podcast. I'm your host, Francesc Campoy, and I'm here with the other host, Mark. Hey, Mark, how are you doing?
I'm good, Francesc. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
That's good. I hear you're a little bit out and about at the moment. You're traveling. I know you're not in San Francisco.
Yeah, I've been traveling for quite a bit. 10 days already somewhere in Europe. I went to Eurodev in Sweden and then GDG DevFest in Nantes. And now I'm in Paris for .go.
Oh, sounds like a tough life. I am here in San Francisco in my living room.
Yeah, it could be worse, really.
It could be a lot worse. It could be a lot, lot worse. Well, it sounds like you're having lots of fun. Well, we've got a great interview lined up with one of our teammates, but why don't we talk about our cool thing of the week before we get stuck into that?
Sure. So the cool thing of the week is that we got a new Cloud Console UI, what we call the new Cloud Management Console.
Yep.
Have you got to use it a little bit?
I have. I've been using it for a little while now. I quite like it. It's very pretty. Lots of nice colors.
It's really pretty. That's true. It's really, really pretty. Every single logo has a slightly different color. I actually really like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you want to get the chance to use it, there's a little try the beta console button that you can press and it'll switch over your console. You can always switch back. It's no commitment. It's okay. it's really nice. My favorite feature, I have two favorite features, but being able to pin things at the top. So I use App Engine a lot. So being able to just go pin App Engine so I can quickly get to it really quickly, I really like that.
And I'm going to guess the second one. Is it the search bar?
Actually, it isn't the search bar, but the search bar is awesome.
The search bar is my favorite one. So, okay, so if it's not the search bar, what is it?
Okay, so I actually really like on the front page, you can customize your widgets. So you can specify the widgets on the front page that you want to see so that you can get all your up-to-date information about, say, like errors or what's the status for Google Cloud Platform or any of that sort of stuff. So you get that as a glance as you first join. That's really cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. I guess we're just different people. I'm more like, I just want to find whatever I'm looking for without having to set anything up, while you're more like pinning and
that's true.
Modifying and customizing. But yeah, for whatever you like doing, basically you have both. So that's fun.
One thing I do love about the search bar though is there are shortcut keys. So there's a shortcut key that takes you to the search bar and then you can enter in, say you want to look at App Engine or whatever you want to jump to really quickly. So the combination of the shortcut keys and the search bar means you can navigate around the dashboard really, really quickly without having to touch a mouse, which is really cool.
I actually did not know that. And now all of a sudden I'm very interested. What's the shortcut? Do you even know what shortcut?
I can't remember off the top of my head.
I have to find it.
Yeah.
That sounds actually really useful because I'm a Vim user. I don't like mice. English is hard.
Yep. So no, I totally love it. So that is cool. So there you go. There's three features that I love.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. So the pinning, the customizing, and then the search bar.
Oh, it's just /// to open set, open it up, and then you can type like App Engine or whatever you like, and hit enter. So it's just /. It's really nice.
/. You know that that's actually the key to also search in Vim, right?
Is it? Okay. I'm not a Vim user.
Yeah. So it's. That's perfect. Okay, I'm gonna totally use that.
Wonderful. Okay, great. So we had.
So
go ahead.
No, you go.
I was gonna say probably exactly the same thing you were. We recorded a interview earlier last week actually with one of our teammates, Brian Dorsey.
Yeah. Brian Dorsey.
The Brian Dorsey. Yes. We had a great chance to chat with him about Kubernetes.
Yeah. So what do you think? Should we just start playing that interview then?
That's a great idea. Let's play that interview right now.
So we are joined today by one of our wonderful colleagues, Brian Dorsey, who is also a developer advocate for the Google Cloud Platform. We're going to have a chat today about Kubernetes and Google Container Engine. How are you doing today, Brian?
Excellent. Thanks for having me in.
Thank you very much, Brian. Now, of course, the first question I have to ask before anything we go on is it Kubernetes or Kubernetes? I argue about this all the time. I think that's probably the most important thing that we discuss before anything else.
Yeah, I think I'm going to mangle this. I think I met a Greek gentleman who said the actual Greek word is pronounced something like Kubernetes, but it's something that was birthed on the West Coast of the United States, so we pretty much say Kubernetes.
Wonderful. Okay, so before we go on any further, why don't you give us a brief background on yourself so people know who you are if, you know, you're not popular enough already.
Hi, I'm Brian. I'm a developer advocate for Google Cloud Platform. And yeah, I've worked on a few different things, you know, cloud storage, our compute engine, virtual machines, and lately been doing a lot of work with Container Engine and Kubernetes. Also, I love Python and Go, so...
Good.
So that works, right?
Francis. That works. That sounds good. Francis loves the Go as well. That's all we know.
Yeah, a little comment on the name. I just came back from GCP Next in Paris, and French people actually call it Kubernetes.
Oh.
I thought that was really cute.
I found out recently that, is awesome. That it's also Kubernetes in Hebrew.
Ah, there you go. It's cute. I like it.
I probably mangled that as well.
We should make an international pronunciation like downloadable guide or something like that. That would be hysterical.
That would be. Actually, I don't like that. Like, that sounds really good. All right, so we should probably talk about what Kubernetes actually is and why people should care about it and why basically all three of us think it's pretty awesome. So since you're the guest on the show, Brian, why don't you take us away?
Ah, sweet. So, I mean, I think the big picture thing is, like, context-wise, you know, more and more people have access to, you know, lots and lots of computers. And most software today is running across, you know, is already a distributed system. Like, you're running different processes on multiple machines, and keeping track of all those is a challenge. And so, you know, at a very high level, Kubernetes helps you basically run your software, your processes, on a whole cluster of computers. But reason about all of them as one thing, as one entity. So you can say, hey, I want to run, you know, 5 copies of this process. Kubernetes, make that happen somewhere in the cluster. Make sure they stay running. If anything goes wrong, let me know. Restart them. If one of the machine goes down, reschedule them, that sort of thing.
Cool. So that actually sounds a little bit like what we do here at Google, a little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah, like having a lot of machines and trying to run some stuff on it. So, I've heard a lot of people saying, oh yeah, Kubernetes is just the open source version of what we do here at Google, which is Borg. Is that true?
In philosophically, absolutely. So it's like, it's inspired by Borg. But it is a, you know, from the ground up, actually more modern implementation of a lot of these ideas. Nice. Yeah. And in fact, there's a fantastic talk. We can add the links to the show notes, by John Wilkes. Talking about the relationship of Borg and what it looks like as a developer at Google to write code and run that on our clusters. And then, you know, what we've built with Kubernetes. So that's a fun talk, like diving deep into that relationship.
Oh, that's cool.
So Kubernetes, it came from Google. I don't know that much about the history itself, but I know, I believe Red Hat's been involved and a few other companies. Do you know more about, like, where it was conceived and that sort of background stuff?
Absolutely. So, you know, basically 3 very senior folks at Google just noticed this kind of trend of the rest of the world, you know, kind of running into these same situations that Google had, you know, a way of dealing with internally, and decided, you know, to try to prototype up building a kind of a, you know, an initial version of that everybody could use. And then, you know, we actually convinced the company to release that as an open source project. So, you know, that it runs entirely on our cloud platform, and now AWS and Azure and your own hardware, lots of other places. But it's very much taking the philosophies of how Google runs software and releasing that as an open source project. And so it started with a few engineers at Google, and now, as you said, you know, Red Hat's involved, CoreOS is involved, you know, dozens actually of companies and far more individuals from lots of other places. Actually, let's just take a look real quick at the GitHub repo, which now has 10,000 stars, you know, 2,700 forks, 19,700 commits as of today.
There are a few people there. Just a few people. Just
yeah.
A couple.
It's an extremely active open source project. And, you know, we hit our 1.0 release earlier this summer and heading very close to the 1.1 release now.
Cool. So from a more a down-to-earth point of view, like Kubernetes sounds really cool. It allows you to run stuff on machines. I know that the stuff itself, it's basically Docker containers, right?
Right. That's the primary, container.
Primary. Like, what other things can you run actually?
Actually, so yeah. So, the Rocket container format that's kind of, from CoreOS, supported. And then they've been moving like towards consolidating on. So both Docker and Rocket and other folks are kind of moving to, kind of standardizing, some container formats. So, Kubernetes is intended to run multiple container formats, but definitely primarily what people are running is Docker containers.
Cool. So then we're running containers, mainly Docker, but not necessarily. And Kubernetes allows us to just manage them. What does that even mean? Like, what right. do you do with Kubernetes?
And what does that look like from like thing? A developer and operations perspective, right?
Yeah.
So the container gives us a kind of hermetically sealed, container, a little box for our processes. So just starting there, it's kind of amazing because you have a process that every time it starts, it has the same context, right? It always sees the same file system, and that gets us all kinds of great benefits. And, one of those is you can run that same package on different computers and get the same result, right? Which is a huge pain in normally. And then what Kubernetes really brings in is it keeps track of all these things and it helps them find each other. And at a very high level, it lets you talk about your whole cluster declaratively. So when you're actually using Kubernetes, you write a config, usually in YAML, can also be JSON, and you say, okay, I've got this container that has the version of the software I want to run. I would like you to run 5 or 8 copies of this somewhere in the cluster. And I want to make sure that they stay running and, go. And then you kind of push that declaration off to Kubernetes. And then from then on, it's Kubernetes' job to make sure that requested state stays true, right? So if one of those containers dies, it'll restart it. If one of the hosts goes away, it will actually, start up new ones somewhere else. And so that lets you, in a very real sense, sleep more, because the system is maintaining the way you asked it to be set up instead of just kind of a one time, hey, run these things. And then you have to manually somehow figure out how to, or, through automation, make sure that they're running. Kubernetes takes care of that.
I think that's two things you kind of said that really resonate with me, and something I really like about Kubernetes and kind of this ecosystem is one of which is you've got this Docker format that's kind of ubiquitous. And I think that's incredibly powerful. And when you said earlier, you were talking about, coming from Borg to Kubernetes, they're able to look at it and say, okay, these are common things that people are doing in terms of scale, in terms of managing computers, clusters, stuff like that. And putting those two things together, it doesn't matter what that application inside that Docker container looks like. It can be as unique and individual snowflake as, you make inside your own little workspace. But then once you sort of wrap that up, it can just become this ubiquitous format that you can do standard things with. And you're no longer going, I need a scaling solution for Ruby, or I need a scaling solution for Node, or I need a scaling solution for my particular app that's very unique and special. You can take advantage of these pretty awesome tools, which I think is super, super powerful.
Exactly. And if your dev workflow, you've got developers, working, and then you've got testers, actually testing and making sure that things work, maybe the same folks, and then operations folks, like no matter which pieces of software the different containers use, you can use the same process across all of those. Mm-hmm. Really, we all want to kind of choose the best tool for the job, or different teams, in a real service oriented architecture, might choose to use different tools. And this lets you manage them all, but that's kind of one of the fundamental benefits of Docker and containerization.
Yeah. One of the things that I really like about Kubernetes is the fact that what you were saying, this concept of desired state, where basically rather than having to you handle, it's like, oh, this machine went down, let me go and restart this job somewhere else. That's going to be automated directly. And that's cool. But something which I think is even cooler, and I've seen some demos of it, but I think you could explain a little bit more what it is. It's this concept of the rolling updates.
Oh, absolutely. Because
I've seen that at Google, but I have never seen that outside of Google.
It's super powerful. So we've got desired state, right? And when we first set up the thing, I told it, I want 5 web front ends, right? But that number you can change that over time. So you can think of it as like there's a dial, like a volume knob, you know, on your processes. You can like, well, let's turn that up to 11. And, you know, you get all the processes running, right? And so you can kind of turn it up and down there. So that just gets you your scaling right away. So you just tell Kubernetes, oh, I want 8 now and I want 3 now. And then the rolling update. So as you have new versions of your software, you can basically say, okay, I'm going to create a new definition for this new version. And Kubernetes, I want you to slowly start adding more of these, and I'll watch the logs. And as long as everything's going well, we'll just slowly replace the old ones with the new ones. And then we'll have a new version in production. And so that's pretty powerful. But since these containers are hermetically sealed, I think that, you know, they're isolated. They're this one thing. So you can do this atomic upgrade, right? Where you just, you know, replace the previous version with the new one. But the crazy thing is a rollback is actually the exact same process. So going to a previous version is the same, right? And that blows my mind.
I love this, especially as someone I've hand rolled stuff behind a load balancer just because I haven't either had the time or the inclination or the pain point to actually go and automate this stuff. So being able to just go, oh, well, this thing gives me a way to rolling update behind a load balancer or whatever it's in front of, you know, like that's super powerful. Again, a generic solution for a problem we've all encountered one way or another.
So like, let's dive on generic solution a bit. So like we talked about kind of like running these processes. So that's, you know, that's basically like a, you know, a system D or a process manager, you know, kind of thing, right? But across a whole bunch of machines. But you also have to figure out where these things are. So if you want to connect them up to a load balancer, like you mentioned, you know, you have to do that connection somehow. You have to tell the load balancer. So Kubernetes handles that as well. So, you know, as you make this definition, you also make this definition just called a service, and that Kubernetes is aware of where these things are actually running and handles the plumbing for connecting the load balancer to it. And that also gives you this nice static name, which is also a DNS name and an IP address. So you can have each of the different parts of your system have a static name, but the actual, you know, where those things exist, you know, that changes over time, you know, so it might be running here, it might be running there, and your software doesn't have to care. You've got a known location to talk to your cache, a known location to talk to your database, known location to talk to web front ends. And Kubernetes just kind of handles all that. And then, you know, you can plumb logging through and all kinds of other fun stuff. So,
yeah, I guess that's the difference between schedulers and Kubernetes, right? Like Kubernetes is not just scheduling containers. It's actually a little bit more than that, because there's service, service is basically service discovery.
Yes.
So you get that already inside of Kubernetes. You don't need to add another layer on top.
So to take a step back for those not familiar with the term scheduling, do you want to explain what that is?
So yeah, basically scheduling would be, I want to run five copies of this,
yep,
and then just run them. If one of the machines goes down, then just move that container somewhere else. But then I want to be able to say, oh yeah, you know, it's like, I'm going to send a request. Those requests should be handled by one of those five containers that are running.
Yep.
Well, if they keep on moving, how do I target them? So a service is basically just a way of saying, oh, just send it to this service. And Kubernetes just will find whoever is behind that service.
So it intelligently routes through
whatever. And what I really like is the fact that the way you define it is via a very simple concept, which is tags. And that's so beautiful. It's basically just tag stuff saying, I was like, this is a backend, or this is a front end, or this is something for test. And then you can create services saying, oh yeah, target all the front end that are also tests or things like that, which is really simple, but at the same time, it's so powerful that it's like really, really nice to use.
And yeah, those are a key part of the rolling update and helps you do kind of like, you know, people who do kind of red, black upgrades and that sort of thing. You also kind of mentioned, you know, another part of scheduling is, you know, making sure that, you know, you put the new processes in a place where they're going to be successful, right? You put them on a machine that's not too busy, that has enough memory, and that works. And so, Mandy Waite on our team describes that as, you know, you're kind of playing Tetris with your resources,
nice,
right? You've got these oddly shaped combinations of CPU and memory and disk requirements, and then they need to fit in these certain size boxes that are the actual nodes you're running the software on. And you want to maximize that because that's the most efficient. It's going to save you the most money. And it quickly becomes this, you know, kind of multidimensional, complex game of Tetris. And
yeah, I really like that comparison with Tetris. I don't know if you've seen Kelsey Hightower gave a really good talk talking about Kubernetes and at HashiConf.
Mm.
And he actually played Tetris in front of everybody during his talk. That was really good, yeah.
That is super fantastic.
Just to bring home the same point of, yeah, like it's hard to do, but it's automated.
Well, I think we actually had a CloudSpin win. So if people have ever seen our CloudSpin demo, we were running it on virtual machines for a long time to our video processing, and we shifted it to Kubernetes. And I think we got something like a 3 times less resource usage. It was something that affected.
Yeah. I mean, when I created the demo, basically it was like, I just need to get it working. So yep. I did something that I'm sure most of us have done before, which is I'm running one container per machine.
Yep.
And if the machine goes down, just restart it. That's it. So that's easy. But yeah, we're spending a serious amount of money because, you know, it's like you're using one machine per container, which is really not what you want to do. And with Kubernetes, basically we ended up with just 3 hosts and all the containers, same amount of containers. So same performance that we used to have, but automated over only 3 instances.
Nice.
And that was really, really nice and really easy to do. So yeah.
Very, very cool. Okay. So, I guess we should probably start talking about like Google Container Engine.
Oh, right. Google.
Yeah. Google podcast. Container with a K.
Yeah. Like we, it is a Google Cloud Platform podcast.
We actually. So we should talk about that. So like people sometimes, abbreviate, Google Container Engine as GKE.
Yes.
So, you know, you can think about it as kind of like Google Kubernetes Engine, in a way. And you know, so the main, you know, difference there is, so it's running, you know, so Container Engine is hosted Kubernetes. So it's running the, you know, open source Kubernetes. But we handle running the master for you. So, we, you know, maintain that. We keep it up to date. We upgrade, you know, the Kubernetes software itself over time. You just kind of basically handle, you can think about actually using Kubernetes at kind of 2 parts. There's one part that is, you know, setting up the cluster itself and running Kubernetes. And then the other part is like running your software in Kubernetes. So you're kind of like, you know, the config and setup and maintenance of the cluster itself versus actually using the cluster. And, you know, actually internally at Google, it's 2 separate groups who usually manage those things, right? You've got the people that run all the clusters, and then you've got the application groups who actually run their software in the clusters. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a way of basically, you know, letting Google run Kubernetes for you so that you can focus on your app.
So you mentioned that, one of the things that Google Container Engine does is create a cluster. If you were to create your own cluster,
mm-hmm.
like what do you do? You get like, I have five machines in my premises.
Right.
How hard is it to get it working?
So there are a couple of things you get. So Kubernetes kind of comes, you know, out of the cloud kind of world, right? And so there's some stuff you get, you know, in those environments. So whether that's, you know, on Google Cloud or on, you know, other folks' clouds, you get the dynamic like creation and removal of machines. You get APIs for controlling networks. And those are actually kind of the 2 main benefits, that are a little more, that are kind of contrasting to running on your own machines. So the network in particular can be a little bit of a challenge right now, when you're setting up your own stuff. One of the things Kubernetes does is it gives, every pod, so every collection of containers has its own IP address. And so that's really helps simplify the scheduling because you don't have to ever deal with port conflicts or whatever. If, you know, 2 different things are listening on port 80, you know, they're trying to be web servers, you know, you can still schedule them on the same machine, because they get their own IP address. In turn, though, that means that Kubernetes itself needs to have some control over the network. That's not super common, you know, in people's, you know, physical, data centers a lot of times. So, people often run an overlay network like Flannel or, kind of change the way the load balancing and the networking works a little bit, to do that. So that's usually kind of probably the main challenge. Other than that, you know, it's a Go program and, you know, we've got setup guides for a whole bunch of different, environments up on kubernetes.io.
So there's some guides on everything. You have to install some software and make sure that the machines are well connected and all the networking stuff, which is really hard for me to do. I'm not a networking guy. You have to set that up. With GKE, Google Container Engine,
mm-hmm.
how long does it take to create a cluster?
About 5 minutes, you know. So, you know, and most of that's just, you know, machines starting up and scripts running and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's about a minute of your time. So you kind of log into the cloud console, go over to navigate your way down the sidebar to containers and, give it a name, how many nodes you want to have in it, what size, you know, computers those nodes are, how many processors they have, and hit go.
And you're ready to run your containers in there. That's nice.
Yeah,
it's the only way I've ever fired up a Kubernetes cluster. I've never tried to manually do it yet.
I'm so brave. On that note, like, you know, no matter where you're planning on running Kubernetes long term, and I think one of the big advantages of Kubernetes is that, you know, it gives you some consistency to environment for running your software. So you can run it in multiple different cloud providers. You can run it on your own machines. You can run it on your laptop. You know, so you can run the same system in a lot of different places. But if you're kind of like trying to decide whether or not this is something you even want to spend the time on, doing your first experiments in Google Container Engine is just so much easier to tell whether you even care about Kubernetes, like whether you want to spend the time to set it up on your own stuff. So I'd highly recommend that no matter where you plan on deploying.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I've seen more than a few people do that. And yeah, one of the lovely things about Kubernetes is that you can pick it up and move it, which is great. So, well, we would love for you to stay on Google Cloud Platform. We understand that people have needs. That's fair enough. Yeah, it's just such an easy process to get you know, three or four nodes spun up and start deploying things and get playing with it. It's great.
Yeah, and for me, one of the things that I really like is Kubernetes is something that I really like to play with. Like, I know that there's some people that are already using it in production. For our demo, the Google Cloud Sprint, we're using it in production, which is cool. But for me right now, it's just like I'm learning the concepts and playing with it. And the good thing is that the pricing for Kubernetes, if you just want, like, not for Kubernetes, sorry, for Container Engine, up to 5 hosts, which is a decent amount of hosts already, is zero. So you don't pay anything. So like anything. Basically, if you want to play with it, you can create your cluster quite easily, get your machines running, and then start playing with it.
So not paying anything. I'll add a little bit there. You don't pay anything for Container Engine itself. You do still pay for the virtual machines that you're running.
Yeah, which might be running. Yeah, then you get to choose how big or small your machines you want, like we discussed in previous podcast, previous episode. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, so you can choose really small machines and make that very, very like low cost.
If you combine that with our free trial or something like that, then
it
definitely gives you enough time to play with it.
Yeah, it's lots of fun, really.
Or you could fire up 32 core, you know,
nodes and run 10 of them. 532 core, and you end up with 170 cores.
Something.
That's a decent amount, of course, yeah.
Yeah, why not?
Yep.
Why not? That'd be fun.
Let's play.
That sounds like a lot of fun. All right, so that sounds pretty cool. I'm definitely sold. Not that I wasn't before, of course, for Google Container Engine. There's a roadmap. I had a look at it. It looked like, you know, they're slating for a 1.1 release in, what was it, late October. I can't remember off the top of my head what features were coming. Brian, I'm guessing you're closer to those. Are there any particular things that you're looking forward to? You think you're going to be particularly exciting for people?
Absolutely. There's a bunch of stuff coming. It looks like early November kind of timeline for the 1.1 release. That's early November 2015, depending on when you're listening to this.
That's
it's not too far away.
Very, very soon.
So they are continuing work on, you know, kind of just straight up scalability, you know. So the 1.0 release, they were, you know, kind of guaranteeing that everything would work really well up to 100 host nodes. And they're kind of pushing that up to around 250 plus. You know, lots of people are running larger, but they're, you know, kind of conservatively, you know, we've tested everything, you know, all the corner cases are happy, you know, at this size and above. So they're kind of pushing there, you know, improving, you know, network performance a few places, you know, support for later, you know, newer Docker releases, the 1.8x series of things, some schema validation, you know, new APIs and things like that. A couple of things I wanted to call out in particular is there's a hook that you can basically set up an HTTP listener or run a script right before a pod is shut down. You know, so sometimes your code, you know, Kubernetes decides that, you know, you need to get off this host. And so that if it's a planned event, you'll get a hook so that you can kind of
grace. So you can save some stuff to a disk or whatever you need to do.
Yeah,
no. Yes. That's nice.
So that's super nice. There's a new job object coming. So this is, you know, going to be the building blocks for more batch operations. So, you know, right now nice. Kubernetes is kind of focused on long running processes. The job object like really brings in, you could always run, you know, a single, you know, container, a single pod, to completion, you know, just say, I want to run this and make it happy. And it's, you know, Kubernetes has always been able to do that, but the job object allows you to manage, you know, a large number of jobs that you might want to only run a subset at a time to completion.
Mm.
So, you know, you can set up, you know, queue workers, you can set up, you know, if you want to run, you know, 1,000 instances of something, you know, but you only have room to run 25 of them at a time, you can use this to manage that sort of thing.
Can you do like cron type things where you want to do something like once every hour or something like that?
So I'm not aware of a cron right now.
Okay.
That sounds more like almost like MapReduce stuff.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things to do, but not enough resources.
That works.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So you could, cool. You can definitely do MapReduce-y kinds of things, you know, a lot of data processing sort of things. It's definitely hitting those targets. Okay. Like cron is super easy to implement with Kubernetes, by the way, because you can basically take your config of the thing you want to do and you can run kubectl and just say, create this pod, run to completion.
That's nice, yeah.
And, you know, just put that in a cron somewhere, and that'll do its thing. And then the other one I really want to call out is auto-scaling of pods. So, you know,
we get a lot of requests for that.
Yep. So you can basically say, you know, I want to run no fewer than this many and no more than this many, but within that range, run enough to keep, you know, memory or CPU targets in this general area. And then it will kind of reschedule up and down.
That's really cool.
So that's the big stuff coming.
Cool. Very exciting.
All right. I think we're probably coming to a close. Brian, is there anything else about Kubernetes or Container Engine you want to mention we haven't really touched on yet?
I think we covered a pretty good chunk. I just wanted to recommend that people check out kubernetes.io. There's a bunch of docs and good information there, and also the Kubernetes GitHub site. There's also, you know, Kubernetes is very active on Slack, so you can get that info from kubernetes.io. So, okay. You know, please join us, kind of play with things, see how kind of, you know, mapping your apps to this world works. If you've, you know, gotten woken up at night to have to restart something, definitely give Kubernetes a try.
Wonderful. And if people cool. want to contact you directly, Brian, Twitter, yeah. email,
yeah, website. Twitter, email. So I'm Brian with an I, so BRIANDORSEY on Twitter. And you know, you can also email briandorsey@google.com.
Cool. We'll add all of those links that you just mentioned to the show notes. I heard something about the Kubernetes Slack, which I'm not sure if it's true or not. Is it true that they actually have one engineer all the time there, like rotating, not always the same person?
So
but they always have someone from the team to answer questions?
So the Kubernetes team is fantastic. And, you know, in addition to Slack and a few other things, you know, part of being secondary on call is, you know, working on social media to kind of help, you know, people
that's
through,
very nice.
Like get through things. So I'm not going to make the guarantees like absolutely always, but that's part of the, you know, on-call rotation. And there's just like, you know, founders of the team and like, there's just so many people who are just really, really engaged. And then the community is growing so large right now that, you know, whether or not you get a Google engineer there, like there are experts in Kubernetes. They're very active and helping people out all the time.
That's very nice.
I'm really excited about how the community has, you know, come together to really, you know, help people solve problems and make their stuff happen. So
very cool. I know I'm in there. I'm pretty sure I've seen you in there as well, Brian.
I'm actually not there.
You're not there?
Yeah.
I'm very quiet. I don't really say a lot.
But yeah, so yeah, thank you so much, Brian.
And thank you, guys.
And hopefully we'll interview you sometime soon about the next version with cooler things of Kubernetes. Or maybe we can interview you about something else, because you know so much stuff anyway that'd be doable.
That'd be fun.
I'm happy to babble. And, you know, we can bring some folks from the Kubernetes team. So if anybody out there has somebody specific they want to hear from, let us know and we'll bring them out too.
Definitely. And if anyone has any questions about Kubernetes, please fire them through. We always need questions of the week. So we'd love to have those on the podcast as well. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Brian. I think we'll end things there, but we appreciate you spending the time with us.
Likewise.
Thanks so much to Brian for joining us and having a chance to chat to us about Kubernetes. But we have a great question that's come in from one of our listeners, an Alex Van Boxel. He's asked us, we have a lot of data in BigQuery, and he's looking to divide the data into buckets per date. He's quite aware that a table can never be too big because BigQuery is awesome. But he's wondering whether it could be too small. What is the size that is too small for BigQuery? So I think this is a really interesting question.
Yeah, that's the kind of question I'm very curious about because I didn't really know the answer.
Yeah, so we had a chat with a few people about this, and they had a few different perspectives, which I thought were quite cool. We had one of our teammates, Felipe, brought up a very interesting point that he pointed out in the documentation. He said that charges are rounded to the nearest megabyte with a minimum of 10 megabytes data processed per table. So that's something to keep in mind when doing stuff with BigQuery. So if you have tables with really small amounts of data, you're always going to get charged at a minimum of 10 megabytes per query.
Yeah, nowadays, no, I don't think that anyone actually has a table with less than 10 megs. But if you do, yeah, it's good to keep in mind.
Yeah, well, I think that could come up if people leave their data normalized and having like small, like say status tables, you know how you'd normally do that in a database, yeah. Stuff like that. So you could get extra charges that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So good to take care of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we also asked one of the solution engineers here at Google for Work, Terrence, and what he said that he was that indeed there was not too small, which again it's not there's nothing too small, there's nothing too big, like it's BigQuery, it just handles everything you want, but that his rule of thumb it's around 100 gigabytes. So if you have less than that, it's not probably worth sharding, and over that it starts making sense. So if you have like hundreds of megs, probably you're good. If you start having terabytes, then that's where you should definitely start sharding a little bit indeed.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. And for those who aren't as familiar with BigQuery has some great like tooling and built in for running queries across tables that have date formats in them. So you don't have to be afraid of sharding, which is nice. But it just makes it sort of a little bit better if you're
actually it may be a good idea to give a short description of what BigQuery is. It's one of my favorite Google Cloud Platform products actually.
Yep.
Because basically it allows you to do SQL-like requests. So if you know how to write SQL statements, you're good, basically. But if you're gonna query terabytes of data instead of taking minutes or hours, it just takes seconds.
Yeah.
So that's fun.
No, we had a really good chat recently with some people about BigQuery and where was the right place for BigQuery. And I think that the takeaway from that was you have such large data sets that it's taking you hours to process them. BigQuery can allow you to,
yeah.
A, not worry about infrastructure because we manage that for you, but take those hours and move those down into seconds, which I think is really powerful.
Yeah, it's basically what we use internally at Google to query our own logs. And we do have a lot of logs. So yeah, big data, no problem with that.
Yep, definitely. And if you're interested in that stuff, go find one of our teammates, Felipe. He does amazing things with big data, especially on Reddit, especially. He does some really cool stuff.
Yeah.
We should have him on the show. Felipe
Hoffa. I was about to say that exactly. We need one extra accent.
Yeah, most definitely. So many people I want to have on the show. Okay, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah. So that sounds like it's pretty much we're wrapping up the episode.
Sounds good.
Do you agree with that?
I think so. I think next time we'll probably be in different places yet again, but that's okay.
I will probably be in a different country. Yeah. So I'm going to go tomorrow. I'm going to be on my way to DevOx.
Nice.
So if there's anyone, so in Antwerp, in Belgium, north of Brussels. So if there's anyone around there, we're going to have, I think we're going to be 5 people from our team. So that's going to be fun.
That'll be great.
And so if you're around and you want to chat about Google Cloud Platform, just send me a message and we'll be happy to get together. What about you? Any traveling plans?
Well, I have an event here in San Francisco at the end of the week. I will be at Future Stack, which I'm really excited about. Steve Wozniak is going to be keynoting there, so super excited about that. And then after that, I will be in Philadelphia for ClojureConch, which I'm also really excited about. So.
Oh, yeah. You told me about that. Actually, yeah, you're going to be talking about containerizing Closure tools?
Yeah, containerizing development environments, which I'm seeing a lot of people doing lately. I think it's really, really cool.
I'm actually going to be next week at DockerCon in Barcelona, where I will be talking about containerizing developer tools. So yeah, you're not the only one.
Wonderful. All right, Francesc, thank you very much for joining me yet again today.
Very nice to talk to you, Mark.
Good. I'll speak to you later.
Bye.